Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It is August 27th, 2020. I just want to mark this down for the benefit of historians. We have 67 days to go. And we wake up, Hurricane Laura is making landfall in Louisiana. A 17-year-old is charged with murdering two people in Kenosha during protests over the shooting of a black man named Jacob Blake. NBA and Major League Baseball games are postponed after the players declare a boycott. We have wildfires in California. The death toll from the coronavirus is nearing 180,000. By the time you hear that, it'll probably be more than 180,000. An asteroid is heading toward Earth, and Vice President Mike Pence, on the third day of the Republican National Convention, warned us all how awful things would be if Joe Biden was elected president. So welcome to our two guests today. We have David from The Atlantic and Sarah Longwell from, well, the Bulwark and Republican Voters Against Trump. Thanks for joining me on a rather extraordinary day.
Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you.
I want to start with you, Sarah, because you have been doing focus groups. One of the big questions is, how is this convention playing? Is it moving the needle? I'm reading all the commentary from the very online media pundits who are telling us about how this group or that group is going to be reacting to the various speeches. But you've actually gone out in the world and talked to real people. What did you hear?
Charlie, last night I did two focus groups, all college-educated women, who voted for Trump in 2016, but don't think he's doing a great job. I talked to one group from Arizona, one group from North Carolina. I went in locked and loaded with a ton of convention-related questions. I wanted to know about Melania's speech, about how as suburban women they felt this was landing on them or with them. And you know what they said? Nobody's watching it.
Nobody's watching.
So I said, I got one in two groups. There was one person who had watched any of the conventions. And it reminded me that, and it was funny because I tweeted this as my one observation, and it immediately went viral because I think that people sort of recognized it almost like, here we all are sitting on Twitter, watching, you know, the conventions going back and forth with each other and talking about how this is going to land with real Americans. And the fact is, real Americans really aren't paying attention to it.
So, David, this is interesting because, of course, there's always this, maybe the incentive structure is such that we have to overanalyze and pretend that it's really, really important when it might not be. But talk to me a little bit about this convention. I mean, this is, it strikes me as different on so many different levels. Not only is it sort of quasi-virtual, but it's really not a Republican convention. It's a Trump convention, and that was codified earlier this week when they didn't even have a platform.
They do have a platform. They just didn't post their platform. We saw from these terrible events in Kenosha an important element of what the convention really is. And I think Kenosha is going to be a defining element in the Republican convention, which is that the Republican Party is about to make a massive national hero out of Kyle Rittenhouse, the 17-year-old vigilante who showed up, crossed state lines to take part in a demonstration, decided that he was part of law enforcement apparatus, although, of course, he had no right to be, and brought a weapon with him and decided that he was entitled to enter into the riot and to shoot people who didn't obey his orders. He is going to become a huge national hero. And what we're going to see is that the central element of the Trump Republican Party is the right of private deadly force to defend the racial order. That's going to be Trump's voting proposition. And you heard it last night from Tucker Carlson, who puts ideas directly into Trump's brain, that what this election is going to be about is like that couple in St. Louis who didn't open fire, but who are ready to open fire, that to defend the racial order, some people, but not all people, have the right to kill.
So, David, this is what's interesting about what you just said. I was planning on, you know, after our discussion of Kenosha and going through it all, to throw out the radical idea that, you know, they're going to turn him into the 2020 version of Bernie Getz. He's going to be a folk hero. And I figured that you guys would say, okay, Charlie, that's going too far. But you're already seeing it. I don't think this is an exaggeration. Okay, so Ann Coulter may not be the Tucker Carlson, but she's like, I want him to be our president. Okay, so you mentioned Tucker Carlson.
He's bigger. He's bigger than Bernie Getz. Yep. He's William Calley.
Yeah.
Okay, he's William
Calley. For people who forget, that was the My Lai massacre And do you remember they made a song about that?
I remember.
The ballad of Luke.
I am just old enough to remember all this. So William Calley was, he committed, it was in 1968, toward the end of the war. By the time when most people realized the war was going to be lost, and certainly it was an unsatisfactory, disappointing bloodbath that was not achieving anything. And there was this discontent that ordinary people were being sent to fight a war over which they had no control. And there was this beginning of this alienation from the political leaders, but defense of the military men. And Calley was charged for atrocities, and he became a huge national hero. And that's what I think what some people are planning, as you say, for Kyle Rittenhouse, because there are these visuals of him in the middle of the fight against anarchists who are wielding a skateboard, and I think one did have a firearm, and he kills two and wounds three, and this is the vision that a lot of Americans have of their place in today's racial order.
Well, I want to break this down, but you mentioned Tucker Carlson, and I do think this was an important moment. Tucker Carlson goes on national television last night, and this is what he had to say. Let's drop in that audio.
So are we really surprised that looting and arson accelerated to murder? How shocked are we that 17-year-olds with rifles decided they had to maintain order when no one else would? Everyone could see what was happening in Kenosha. It was getting crazier by the hour.
Wow. Okay, Sarah, who can be surprised 17-year-olds armed with semi-automatic rifles, who could be surprised that we now rely on them? This just struck me as the embrace of vigilantism by Trump world.
Yeah, that's the first time I've heard that audio. I got to say, just listening to it, I mean, it sounds slightly different to me. Like, it's hitting me almost like he's saying, who can be surprised that, like, you know, crazy 17-year-olds would take it upon themselves. Like, I don't know. Are you sure he's endorsing it it sounds less like an endorsement and more like a justification.
I think it's a rationalization. I think he's mounting in the context of a lot of right-wing media, which is, as David mentioned, is embracing this kid and treating him as a victim slash hero. David?
Sarah, Tucker is there engaged in the technique he learned from Glenn Beck, who used to do this at 5 o'clock, which is, I'm just asking questions. I'm not saying there is a conspiracy of Jewish bankers in control of the world. I'm asking, are there bankers in control of the world, and are they Jewish? That's it. It's just a question. It's not a statement. And the other thing to understand about the way Fox News operates, and I wrote about this in a website I used to operate, Fox News is part of an ecosystem, a lot of which is unintelligible unless you also understand the under news. And the example I used was from 2011. Greg Gutfeld, who's sort of the jester on Fox News, made a comment about Obama being gay for socialism. And Gutfeld, if pressed, would have said, well, I'm using gay for in the way that the kids do, meaning enthusiastic about. But the joke only worked if you understand there was a lively discussion on Facebook about how Obama was secretly homosexual and how Michelle Obama was secretly a man. And he was playing off that. And that's what Tucker was doing. I tweeted a couple of pretty anodyne things about this, and I'm now receiving this massive sewer of justification, some of it very explicitly racist, some of it quite explicitly Nazi, others, you know, more from the militia fringe. But there are tens of thousands of people who believe that Kyle Rittenhouse was acting to defend law, order, white womanhood. And when Tucker asks his questions in that Glenn Beck manner, he's preserving his survivability within what is, after all, a major American corporation that does have to worry about advertisers, while opening the door to what is coming.
Well, let me just, there's a lot going on here, and I wrote in my newsletter that the narratives are quite messy. Basically, the narratives about the police shooting and about the Rittenhouse shooting are messy, by which I mean there's enough material for both sides to basically say that their position is validated. So one of the big defenses about Rittenhouse is that he was acting in self-defense. And you mentioned, David, there was the video of him being chased down the street by folks who were attacking him. And there's one guy who smashes him on the head with a skateboard. So the question is that a legitimate defense of his actions? Is it a mistake to charge him with first degree murder? And I think one of the most important things to remember is there were actually two shootings. There were two incidents. He shot and killed a man in a parking lot first, and then was chased later by protesters. So I do think that a lot of this is you have to put it in context, but you're going to see this culture war continue to flare because, as I said, it's like everybody has, this is the moment that they're going to be focusing on. You can focus on the fact that he's, you know, a right-wing militia member who is sitting in the front row of a Trump rally. He's, you know, all in on Trump. Or you can focus on the fact that you had these rioters, anarchists who are beating him up. So again, that's part of the messiness of all of this.
But Charlie, let me ask you this. Here's a Rorschach. Here's an important Rorschach test.
Sure. So it is a Rorschach test.
At that confrontation, there were two groups of people making a lot of noise, neither of whom wore uniforms, badges, or took orders, and both of them had weapons. And it's so interesting that some people look at Kyle and see not another rioter, but an assistant cop. But he's not an assistant cop. He's another rioter who had no business being there, who should have been home, who was not acting in self-defense at all. Now, once the scuffle breaks out, you can then do a ballet minuet, you know, frame by frame dissection of who hoisted which weapon first. As you say, even there, he did fire first. But the point is, he is a rioter too. He's not the police. He had no legitimate right of self-defense in the situation because he had no right to be in this situation.
And he's a 17-year-old with a kid. I guess, Sarah, you know, I am trying to put this into context, and it strikes me as relevant that this takes place with the day or the day after. You have the Republican National Convention featuring people who came out and were wielding guns and brandishing guns at protesters. I feel like we've moved one step closer to people saying, you know, yes, we are in this cultural hot civil war, and if that involves shooting and killing people on the other side, we're okay with that. I mean, it feels like we're sort of on dystopian fast forward here.
Yeah. I have been thinking about this in a slightly different context, which is I have been wondering as the unrest has continued, whether or not, you know, clearly this convention has showed us that Trump is leaning as hard as he can into the notion of he is the man for law and order, that Joe Biden is hiding in his basement and siding with Black Lives Matter and the protesters, and that, you know, MS-13 is coming to move next door. And this entire convention is geared toward two things: riling up the base and then seeing if they can scare the suburbs enough into submission and voting for him.
And blaming this on the Democrats.
Right. Exactly. Tagging it to Joe Biden, tagging it to the Democrats. You know, they're very clear that whenever they talk about the unrest in the cities, these are Democratic run cities. So that is key to the strategy. And so I have been sort of open to the notion that this could resonate with some of these voters, that it could potentially work, because I've heard it in my focus groups 2 weeks ago. I had noticed a switch where people had previously really been focused on the racial justice element, and a lot of these college-educated suburban women, you know, were really kind of fired up and on the side of the protesters. But the last time, I really heard it start to move in the other direction. There was a lot more talk of looting, a lot more talk of rioting, still sympathetic to George Floyd and the ultimate goal, but you could just start to feel that there was like a shift in public perception. And so I really wanted to dig in on that last night, and I did. And here is what was just completely fascinating to me. I did two groups, one in North Carolina, one in Arizona, and they were polar opposites of each other. They were demographically exactly the same, but in North Carolina, they were, you know, people were saying things like, yeah, it's really time to rethink how we deal with race. And, you know, somebody even said the words white privilege. And, you know, there was this whole like, yeah, you know, there's an awakening going on in the country. But they had not heard about what was going on in Wisconsin. When I asked them if they'd heard about Wisconsin, they said no. I mean, just and somebody kind of said, yeah, a little bit. But, you know, and this is not that surprising. It's sort of like them not watching the conventions. People just aren't as plugged in as you might think. But then interestingly, and in fact, one of those women in North Carolina had actually gone to some protests and talked about how they were peaceful. But then I moved over to the Arizona focus group. And I'm just going to read you a few of the quotes. So they had all heard about Wisconsin. And so one said, if you're obeying the law, usually you won't get shot. If a cop tells you to stop, stop, follow orders. Did cops go overboard? Yes. Don't shoot a dude 7 times. But if you follow directions, we wouldn't be here. If he was white, no one would have cared. There was also sort of general agreement that Trump was right to send in federal forces to Wisconsin, and including not just Wisconsin, but sort of going back to the George Floyd. You know, people, I think, this is something that I wondered about, is would people start to revise their assessment of how Trump had handled things as the unrest goes on? And they think, actually, it's good. We need more, you know, troops going in. And one woman said, Trump is right. We should send in the National Guard. Why do our troops go overseas, but can't police here? And then the other person said, one other person observed to much nodding, I think people are looking for an excuse to run wild and do whatever they want. They can loot, burn, and blame it on white people. You can peacefully protest. No one has an issue with this. It's when you start violence, burning, looting, et cetera, you aren't making yourself look good. So it was just totally polar opposite. And in that group, there were 3 Trump voters and 3 undecideds. And all 3 of the undecideds, no, I'm sorry, 2 of the undecideds listed these protests as a reason that they would be more likely to vote for Trump. So really? I think there's something going on. Like, I don't know if it's the apocalyptic civil war, but I do think it's having an effect on where people are right now.
Okay, so there's a piece in the New York Times this morning that's got a lot of people freaked out on the front page about a guy who is a 41-year-old undecided voter from Wisconsin named John Garrity. And he's quoted as saying, after feeling 100% on the fence about who he will vote for in November, he is increasingly nervous that Democratic state leaders seem unable to contain the spiraling crisis, which would suggest that Democrats in Wisconsin need to be pretty nervous. So your take on this, David Frum?
I think that's right. I agree with both that article and with Sarah. I think this does what Trump has been doing for the past, ever since he's president, but especially since the George Floyd killing, has been looking for a way to use these events to consolidate white support behind him as the defender of the racial order. And it hasn't worked until recently because there are just too many other things going wrong. Also because people feel that some of the critics of the racial order may have something of a point. You know, some of the defenses of the racial order have seemed, as Sarah said, a little excessive, 7 shots, strangling a man to death. But there is no doubt that the defense of the racial order resonates powerfully with white voters, and that they instinctively see someone like Kyle Rittenhouse, who is objectively no different from anyone else who showed up without an invitation at this event, carrying weapons to intervene in this cockpit of confrontation. They see him as the law because he was there because his side of the riot was in defense of the racial order. And Donald Trump is trying to mobilize those feelings. And those feelings, they're the most powerful political force in American history. They are always there. Maybe they're not quite as powerful now as they have been at other times, but they're powerful enough. And that's Trump's only hope, because there's nothing else. The economy is a shambles. His management of the disease is a disaster. In the course of the next 4 years, the U.S. economy is going to be overtaken by the Chinese economy. The alliance structure is collapsing. World trade is in crisis. Everything else is a shambles. But he's got this one argument: I will defend the racial order. And Kenosha gives him this proof point.
Well, and one little wonky point about Wisconsin, of course, you know, the partisan divide here is pretty massive. And yesterday you had the Speaker of the Wisconsin State Assembly. His name is Robin Voss. He explicitly blamed these killings by Kyle Rittenhouse And he used the word entirely. He blamed them entirely on the state's Democratic governor, Tony Evers. It is entirely on Governor Evers' shoulders because he refused to do what the locals asked for. So there is a particular dynamic here. And Evers, I have to say, is a weak figure and has not really navigated this particularly effectively. So there is the possibility that this will cost Evers re-election without necessarily affecting the presidential election. So just moving ahead, because I do think that this is a real problem in Wisconsin, the dynamics in Wisconsin. But I thought it was interesting. A lot of people were saying yesterday that, you know, Joe Biden needed to come out and condemn the violence himself. He needed to do it, explicitly. And by midday yesterday, he had done it. And I don't know. It struck me, Sarah, it struck me that Biden was pretty much tone perfect on all of this. I don't know, you know, how widely disseminated it is, because 6 hours later, Josh Hawley was on Fox News saying that Joe Biden refused to repudiate, you know, the violence. But Joe Biden did yesterday, didn't he?
Yeah, and it was, I thought, pitch perfect. And in some ways, I think that, you know, the thing about Biden is that Biden always does the thing that sounds that seems to never happen. But when he does it, you're like, yeah, that's the most reasonable, rational thing. You stand with the protesters. You stand against systemic violence. You're there for peaceful protests, but you're against looting and rioting, and you explicitly condemn violence and you do it forcefully. And that's exactly what he did. And frankly, it's the kind of thing on like what most reasonable people can agree that that's the right message. I think the problem is that because this is Trump's one shot, and because they have no fidelity whatsoever to the truth, that they will lie and constantly say Joe Biden wants to defund the police, Joe Biden wants to leave you vulnerable. I mean, and they will spend hundreds of millions of dollars. I mean, the main campaign commercial that Trump has just been blitzing the Midwest with is this older white woman in her home. A robber is trying to get in, and she's calling the police, and no one's picking up and answering. I mean, they will drive in that fear and anger and anxiety, and that's their only chance. And they're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to try to make that stick. Because the fact is, if this is an election about COVID, which is the other deep anxiety, Joe Biden wins, because people do not think that Trump has handled COVID well. But he has weirdly been able to make people think that, despite the fact, this is such a weird trick he's been able to pull, despite the fact that this is happening in Trump's America very much, people still think, and maybe it's because he just has said it over and over again, people still view him as the law and order candidate.
So before we move on here, I just want to drop a little detail that's going to make everything worse here in Wisconsin. I keep thinking this becomes worse. It gets worse than this. The Wisconsin Department of Justice is, of course, investigating the police shooting of Jacob Blake in the back 7 times. They're investigating this, and they issued a preliminary report yesterday that included a little detail that he acknowledged that he was in possession of a knife. Now, and they found a knife on the floor of the car. What we don't know is whether the police were aware he had a knife, and his attorneys are saying he did not have the knife in his hand. He was not threatening anyone with the knife. But I will tell you, it's extraordinary the way Republicans and conservatives in Wisconsin are seizing on that now to discredit the Black Lives Matter movement and to defend the police. Everybody has their own narrative. So this is not a moment where people are stepping back and coming together. In Wisconsin, this has become so polarized. And this whole possession of the knife thing is just gone nuclear. So I have to ask you this, but since we're talking about the coronavirus, we're nearing 180,000 deaths. We're going to hit more than 200,000 by election day. And it just occurs to me that it feels like, once again, we've forgotten about it, that it doesn't even seem to resonate. I know that we have a short attention span in this country, and we lost interest in it earlier this year, which led to the premature reopening. You know, have we in fact become numb to it? And David, you're sitting up there in Canada right now. The Trump White House was sort of counting on simply that people would find it acceptable, would normalizing this level of death. And is that in fact happening?
I've been writing for months that the Trump strategy, the effect that Trump did have a coronavirus policy, and it was take the punch. Let the thing rip through the country. let it infect who it infected, let it kill who it would kill. You know, it was not going to be the Black Death. Society would go on. And since most of the people who would get very, very sick were not parts of the Trump coalition, and since Trump is not president of all of America, but only of his coalition, it was a price he was willing to pay rather than accept economic loss. And his hope was if you could just muscle through, you would have, you know, an acceptable rate of loss. And I think the clear, if you judge what people think from what they do, the White House clearly has decided that 200,000 casualties, even 300,000 or 400,000, is more acceptable than the actions they would have to do to keep the casualties lower, especially when you keep in mind that the casualties overwhelmingly fall on urban dwellers, ethnic minorities, and other people whom Trump doesn't care about very much.
So, Sarah, what do you think? What are you hearing?
Yeah, you know, we at Republican Voters Against Trump, we released an ad yesterday from one of Trump's former DHS officials who ran counterterrorism and
oh, it's
threat.
Very powerful.
And one of the things she talks about is how, you know, they had had a plan for 15 years. They'd had a plan for a pandemic. And as the pandemic began to reach our shores, they were frantic in the administration, sort of the career officials and even the political appointees who wanted to handle it. And they were talking with experts. And the Donald Trump said, don't do it. Just stop. Don't talk about it. You're going to crater the economy and I don't want to hear about it. And that he just dismissed it and would do nothing about it. And I played that ad for both the focus groups last night. And the North Carolina focus group was like, yes, that he has not done his job. He has mismanaged this crisis. And they were ready to blame him. The Arizona group, which again was the one that was much more forgiving of Trump, they said, well, of course he didn't want to crater the economy. That makes sense that he wouldn't want to hurt the economy. And I think that's something that David just said is really important about the Trump coalition, which is a lot of these voters, it's not that they're rich, but they are in some ways, they are impacted by the virus, but there is a segment of them where the impact is sort of minimal, you know, like, yeah, they've got to stay inside, but it's not, the anxiety of it doesn't penetrate them the same way, not the, in terms of the health consequences. They are much more worried about the economic environment and how that works. And so I do think that there's sometimes people just assume, well, there's a pandemic and Trump has clearly mismanaged it, and therefore, you know, it works against him totally. And I do think it nets out against him, but there are chunks of the country that actually, you know, feel like the problem is that we're not moving the economy ahead fast enough, that we're allowing the virus to control us, that we need to open things up.
So, David, right before we started the podcast, I asked you, are you in Washington? Are you in Canada? And are you allowed to go back and forth? And you had an interesting story to tell about that. You're in Canada, right?
I am. I'm in Prince Edward County, Ontario, which is directly across the lake from Rochester. And my family spent the past 30 summers here, and we have some we have a house here and some land here. I've been making this trip, as I say, for 30 summers. When I drove north on the 4th of July, the border was closed to almost all traffic. Because I'm a dual national, I was allowed to cross, but I was minutely questioned about what my plans were. And did I have, in particular, a plan to self-isolate for 14 days, as the law requires? And the officer wanted to know things like, what was I going to do for groceries? My wife, who was in a separate car, she was traveling with our dogs. How were we going to get the dogs walked? And they checked
really?
That we were going to self-isolate. And then every day for 14 days, I received either a robocall or a text from Health Canada, just confirming that I was where I said I would be. They had taken at the border my phone number and my email address, and they also took my credit card number so they could see if I was making purchases off the property.
Oh, wow.
And then about two-thirds of the way through, I got a call from a human being who very solicitously asked about our well-being and whether we had sufficient food, did we need anything, but reaffirming that we were to stay on our property for 14 days. And the reward for that, now that Americans will say, well, gee, that's nothing like that in the United States. The reward for that is once we step off the property, there's not a single case of COVID in our county of 25,000 people. The restaurants are functioning. People mask, I mean, unanimously. Very Canadian. My first day out, I had an errand at the local grocery store, and everyone was wearing masks. And I, very, very rural place, and I asked one of the clerks, had there been any issue with people wearing masks? And she said, oh no, there's a sign on the door.
Wow.
Right. It's like a sign that says you have to, so people do.
Well, then, of course.
It's like the joke, how do you get all the Canadians out of the swimming pool? Hey, all you Canadians, get out of the swimming pool.
But so when you describe it as kind of like going into a first world country from the United States, which is a strange way of thinking of it.
Yeah. And it should be said, Ontario is governed by one of the most conservative politicians in all of North America, Doug Ford, the brother of the famous rock and roll mayor, Rob Ford. He's the only Canadian, the only politician in Canada who in 2016 said he would support Donald Trump if he had a vote in the United States. Big, meaty guy from exactly that kind of Trump voter community, you know, well-to-do, but not well-educated. And what he does is he pours all of that populist energy into, you know, abusing people who don't wear masks. He calls yahoos. It's not perfect. Really? There've been a lot of mistakes here, but it's worked. And I know when I drive back, which I will do next week, that there will be no questions at the border. My daughter flew back ahead of, and not only was she asked no questions about quarantine, but the border control officer, the U.S. border control officer at Pearson Airport, mocked her for wearing a mask.
Really? That's fantastic. All right. So tonight, Donald Trump delivers his big speech. What do you expect, Sarah? Is there anything, I guess what I'm really getting at is, at this point, is there anything that is happening at this convention or that he will say that will change the trajectory of this campaign? I think we have agreed that the violence in places like Kenosha, the law and order issue, might change things. But is anything at this convention or anything the president is going to say, will it materially affect the fundamentals of this race?
No, I don't think so. I mean, one of the things people keep asking, you know, well, what does Trump have to do to sort of win over all of these, you know, sort of disaffected voters? And I say, well, he has to be a different person. You know, the one thing that Trump could do, he keeps bringing in consultants to tell him different ways to beat up Joe Biden, different lines of attack. The one thing he could do to really help his political situation is to do his job and do it moderately competently. You know, spare a word for racial strife. Focus on the health crisis, acknowledge that it exists, do things to try to ameliorate the problem, give people some direction about things like schools opening and what we're going to do about the economic crisis. Like, that is what he could do to really help him. I mean, I expect that he will be divisive, that it will probably be along the lines of American carnage, unless what he's done by sending out Don Jr. and a lot of his other kind of henchmen to do the doom and gloom, maybe he'll try to be a slightly sunnier version of himself. I don't know, but I don't think that what happens at the convention is going to matter. I'll tell you what I do think is really going to matter. I think the debates are really going to matter. I think it has become clear to me in kind of talking to people that what they want to see is Joe Biden, Donald Trump, mano a mano. They want to see, is Joe Biden up to this? Does he look senile or dementia riddled the way that Donald Trump portrays him? Or can he take on Trump and offer an affirmative vision? I heard that a ton last night. What they all know about Trump, but they want to know, what is Joe Biden's affirmative vision? And that they feel like that could potentially be persuasive, because they don't like Trump, but they don't like Democrats either. They don't like the media, and they do have a lot of anxiety. And the thing about anxiety is it just tacks on to whatever's there. And I think if it tacks on to COVID, that hurts Trump. I think if it tacks on to, potential violence, that helps Trump.
Okay, so David, let me just bounce this off of you, okay? And this may be, you know, completely off, but I'm thinking back to the 1980 election and some of these other and even 2008, where the race was felt relatively close for a long time because people, you know, were not convinced about the opposition. And so in 1980, right before the election, you had the 1-year anniversary of the Iranian hostage crisis. And people said, okay, you know, we may not know that much about this Ronald Reagan, this right-wing guy here, but we're just not going to go with this anymore. I just wonder how voters are going to break at the end, particularly when we hit the 200,000. Do you understand the dynamic that I'm talking about here? Is that they're disgusted with Trump, but Biden hasn't sealed the deal. It's just a matter of people getting their heads around what they're going to do, what they're prepared to put up with.
Well, let's look at those two analogies. And I think they show the danger of the situation we're in. So in 1980, the final tally, if I remember it right, was something like this. 50% Ronald Reagan, 42% Jimmy Carter, 8% John Anderson. That is, the race, what could have been a close election actually became a Reagan landslide because the Democratic coalition cracked. And Carter, had, of course, had faced a very serious primary challenge from Ted Kennedy. So this time, the incumbent president's coalition is unified. And the other analogy you cite is 2008, where one party got 53% of the vote and the other got about 45 and a little bit percent of the vote. That's probably what's going to happen this time, too, except this time the 45% has a real chance of winning. And one of the things to worry about is what does a Trump second term look like if he once again, I mean, Donald Trump got half a point more than John McCain in 2008. He got half a point more than Michael Dukakis in 1988. And he got less than, significantly less than Al Gore and less than John Kerry. Yeah. What if we normalize that the reactionary, violent Trump coalition, they get to exercise power with 45 or 46, and the other, the urban minority coalition on the coast with 53%, they are locked out forever. At that point, you have to wonder, you know, one of the things that people often will say when you make this point is, hey, this is a republic, not a democracy. But I think there are a lot of your fellow citizens who think, I thought this was a democracy. Don't they always tell me it's a democracy? And if it's not a democracy, maybe it should be.
So I started, Sarah, you know this, I started with my daily newsletter doing a countdown, which was what I intended to be kind of a countdown diary, because I had done this back in, I think it was 2012 or something, sort of every day, sort of taking my temperature, what I was thinking, what I thought was going to happen. And it makes for kind of embarrassing reading after the fact. I haven't done as good a job as I should have of doing that. But, you know, it is August 27th, 2020. So this goes on our permanent record. I'm just sensing that people have a lot higher level of anxiety today than you might have a week ago. So if I was taking your temperature right now, where are you at on this race? Just right now.
Well, I'm as anxious as the average liberal these days. I mean, I have total 2016 PTSD. I think that Trump getting a second term is catastrophic for the country. And so, and I think that, you know, to be in the middle of a pandemic that has been pretty clearly mismanaged and where the president gets extremely low marks, to have there be an economic crisis as well as things on fire in the streets, seems to me that the incumbent president should be quite far behind. And he's not far enough behind in a lot of these key swing states for my taste. And it concerns me that things are going to tighten in kind of a normal political cycle kind of way. And I think that the next 2 months are going to be some of the most anxiety producing for those of us who think that Donald Trump, who desperately feel that he needs to be beaten, they're going to be some of the most anxiety producing of our life, because we're going to have, there's still a bunch of known unknowns, right? We know there's going to be October surprises, maybe on both sides. We know there's going to be debates that are going to make a real difference for the people that are still on the fence. And we know that we're still going to be in the middle of a pandemic and continuing to see racial unrest in the streets. And so, you know, and also we don't know how this election is going to look. Like, how many people are going to mail in their ballots versus how many people are going to show up at the polls? Can the mail system handle all the ballots? Can the polls handle all the voters? I mean, it's just such a fraught time. I'm just worried about everything.
These polls would suggest that he is, you know, narrowing the gap. But there's one other factor here, David. I know that you've written about this rather extensively. This is a president who has signaled very, very clearly that he is prepared to do anything to get reelected, that he will use every lever of power, even if it shatters constitutional norms, even if it is illegal. There is no limit to what he is capable of at this moment. And we need to get our heads around what that might mean over this next 2 month period.
Well, let me give you one example to affirm that very powerful point. I wrote in The Atlantic about taking part in a wargaming exercise about transition integrity. And we played a number of scenarios over 4 days. And one of the tactics that was used by one of the, and I played Team Trump twice. One of the tactics that was used by our team was we sent in, at the order of the Attorney General, federal marshals to seize mail-in ballots that we asserted had been cast fraudulently. The Post Office is a federal institution. And as you say, I mean, just, you know, the Trump people, the good news is they're never as smart and organized as in real life as they are in one's anxious imagination. The fact that this administration is dominated by crooks and morons has been a powerful gift of God to the American people. But they are desperate crooks and morons. And they will do, there are a lot of tools in the president's arsenal. To your question about anxiety, I don't think there is really any way that President Trump can win this election in a way that every president of the 20th century won the election by getting more votes than his opponent. But I think there are ways he can win without getting more votes than his opponent, by manipulating the voting process, by preventing people from voting, and then by both relying and inflaming the unrepresentative elements of the U.S. election system. And that is really, that's the thing to worry about. You say, what do you worry about in the second Trump term? I worry less about what Donald Trump will do, although I do worry about that, than about what it means for American democracy that he can win two terms in a row.
See, David, I completely agree with you. I've actually made some notes for a piece on, you know, sort of the deeper anxiety. And the obvious anxiety is he wins and we have another 4 years of it. But I think for me, the deeper anxiety is, what does this say about my fellow Americans? What does this say about the American constitutional, I mean, not the constitutional system, about just about the state of our political culture, our image of ourselves? Who in fact we are. Is that what you mean? I'm really at the point where I think that the disillusionment and the alienation will be profound and perhaps lasting for generations as a result of that. I know that sounds extreme, but I think that would be the consequence. Whatever Donald Trump does won't be as bad as what the country has done to itself by putting him back in power.
But when you say the country, let me be more specific about this.
Yeah.
So I was in the George W. Bush administration, and of course, he won with fewer votes than Al Gore in 2000. And George Bush personally and everybody around him saw this as an enormous problem. It was obviously theoretically possible for this to happen, but it hadn't happened since the 1880s. When Bush finally got the word from the Supreme Court that made him president, he gave a speech which was unifying. It was, I'm going to be the president for everybody, and I'm going to listen to the people who disagreed with me. And his first months in office were all about gaining the legitimacy that had eluded him at the ballot box. And he did things like he spent so much time with Ted Kennedy and renamed the Department of Justice building for Bobby Kennedy and worked on education, made the education initiative equal in weight to the tax initiative, and thought very, very hard actually about stealing Al Gore's ideas on climate. And I'm sorry to say he didn't, but that was a real live possibility in the first, and I worked on that issue. Bush had in the campaign talked about possibly regulating carbon dioxide and greenhouse gases as a pollutant, and that was weighed for 2 months. I think one of the reasons that the country experienced 9/11 as in the way that it did was because it was hungry for national unity. And 9/11 then became a way to legitimate the Bush presidency in a way that the election had not done. And that was one of the things that unfortunately we lost when Iraq went wrong. But this will be different because Donald Trump never for a minute experienced it as a problem that he lacked democratic legitimacy. And if he wins a second time, he will again win with a minority of the vote and probably a bigger gap than in 2016. And he has governed and will continue to govern the country on behalf of an explicit, self-conscious minority against the objections of the majority and in hostility to that majority. That's the thing I worry about.
You know, Sarah, thinking back on this, I think back to the 2000 election, which we thought was like the worst possible, most divisive thing in the world. And David talks about how George W. Bush reacted to it. I was really kind of touched by Mona Charon's piece yesterday, where she talks about how what a hyperpartisan she was, and I, of course, was as well, and how remarkable it was, though, to watch Al Gore be gracious in defeat. That Al Gore could have fought this. Al Gore could have launched a grievance movement. Thinks what he could have done about that election, and yet he did not. You know that there's no possibility, no chance that we will see that kind of grace from Donald Trump.
Yeah, you know, I was 20 when that happened, and so I don't know that I recognized quite how big of a deal that was. But also, I think I took for granted, certainly at that age, the idea that, like, this is, of course, how people behave, right? The peaceful transition of power is something that's so deeply baked into who we are that you take it for granted. But the thing is, it's so funny, you know, last night, I do this sometimes, and it's not my... I was with the Arizona group. I really wanted to try to understand the gap between how much they all recognize that Trump is a narcissist and a bully. They all recognize that he is not really a good person. I can't always reconcile the gap between that and then their just resistance to why they wouldn't vote for a Democrat. And I started to ask, does it bother you that he, you know, talks about postponing elections and like acts like a king? Do you think that's wrong? And they kind of did this thing where it was like, they just kind of looked at me blankly, where they acknowledged that he did it, but they wouldn't acknowledge that it was bad enough to not vote for him. And I feel like there's something, that's the thing that makes me the saddest. That's the thing that makes me the most afraid, is that the American people are not invested anymore in the decency and goodness and sort of core values of our democracy and our politicians. In some ways, it's because people have been failed, you know, by a lot of, they're so cynical and they just think, well, this is what politicians do now. And so I feel on some level that it's they have been failed by this, but there's another level where it's just it feels all so unserious, like we just don't take it seriously anymore who we're supposed to be as Americans, and it's just sad.
David, that's what you're talking about. We've kind of normalized a lot of this behavior, haven't we? We've kind of normalized things that we would have found unthinkable. Well, I would think that we would have thought unthinkable just a few years ago. But yeah, people kind of shrug their shoulders. I mean, that is how self-governing republics die, isn't it? I mean, when people just no longer care.
Well, when we say we, who is the we here? I think that there are many people in the Republican and Democratic coalitions in 1980 and 1990 who would have shrugged in just the way Sarah describes voters shrug now. The difference is that political leaders did not. Especially so long as the Cold War lasted, but even a little while after the Cold War, that the political leaders, it was the political leaders who defended the game. It's always been a very dangerous reliance to count on people who have their own lives, don't think very hard about the requirements of political order, to put something as abstract as the rules of the game ahead of something as real to them as their tribe. But it was the job of the politicians, of the media people, of
the
everyone,
thought leaders.
The thought leaders, to say the rules of the game matter more than tribe. And the story of the Trump years is, I don't endorse the attitudes of people in Sarah's focus groups. Of course, they should be better citizens, but it's also not exactly their job. I blame the people we know, our friends, the people who should be defenders of the constitutional order, who are saying that my tribe is more important to me than this constitutional order. And that's why we're in trouble, not because the people are any better or worse than they were 25 years ago. They're the same. It's the leaders who are worse.
I think you're right. Can I make a confession, though? Because last night I had kind of a flashback. I was reading something about how, you know, the the Republican Party has just rejected any serious attempt at governing because they don't want to compromise. There's no reaching across the aisle in any way whatsoever. And there's a lot of other, you know, reasons for that as well. And I was thinking about the tribalization and my own reaction to this back in 2000, how hyper-partisan we were, how we hung on every Chad, and how we just wanted Bush to win no matter what. But I had this moment. And I'm a little ashamed about this, but it was real, and it was shared by a lot of I think people on the right. Do you remember back in 2012 when Republicans convinced themselves that Barack Obama was going to be defeated? Then Superstorm Sandy came along, and he went to New Jersey. He did a fine job. And do you remember when Chris Christie hugged Barack Obama? Do you guys remember this? Do you remember how angry Republicans were, how furious they were, how what a betrayal it was that Chris Christie would have hugged the president who was joining in this effort to save the country and to save lives? And I remember being pissed off. And you know what? You think this is how we get to this moment. I mean, what an unworthy, what we would normally think of as a fundamentally un-American response that was. But as David points out, you know, we've been feeling this way for a long time. And I look back on that and go, boy, if that's where I was right there, maybe you can understand how, you know, violent the divisions are today. I mean, I was part of that. You guys are basically saying we don't want to know you anymore, right? I mean,
I'm trying to remember the exact date of Hurricane Sandy. What was it? It was October, right?
Yeah, it was right before the election, it was really the heat of this campaign, you know.
Okay, so that means I had already finished and completed copy editing my book, Why Romney Lost, which was published 36 hours after the election. And after the book came out, I said, while I write fast, I don't write that fast. That the fact that Republicans thought that they were going to win that election was itself an indication of the problem.
It was.
And it was just to everyone in the Republican world, it was apparent that not in the Republican world, it was apparent that they were not going to. But because they had, and that's, and I say I voted for Mitt Romney. I think he would have been a fantastic president. I was foreman. I've always admired him for as long as I've known him in public life. And I continue to admire him almost more than any political figure active today. So this is not any personal reflection on him. But it was a mark of how far the Republican thought leadership had drifted away from the country as it is. And this has been one of my themes since I started writing in the 1990s. To be a patriot is to love your country as it is. You have to see it as it is, and you have to love that thing. And it's like saying, you know, I love my kids, but I endlessly criticize them. I love my spouse, but I'm always sending them to some program to fix them up. If you're doing that, you don't love them. You love them when you accept them. And we have to accept our country. And that's the test of love.
Wow. Sarah, you get the last word today.
I want to go back to something David said about our political leadership, because I think that's really right. That to pull ourselves out of this, and we're clearly, we all feel pretty dismal about it, is to have, and I think, honestly, I think there's something about Biden that can do this. We do have to want our political leaders to put their arms around each other during a hurricane when their state's just been badly damaged, and for all of us to exist together as Americans. Like, I think that we do need leaders to start stepping up and like reinvest in the rules of the game. And that probably is the only way that we're going to change it. And I don't know whether that's a top-down thing or a bottom-up thing, but it's probably a top-down thing. And I think that, I don't know, I think we've got a lot of work to do, all of us, even those, you know, people always say, well, what are you never Trumpers going to do? But I think there's really something to be said for trying to figure out how we restore that sense of like honor and duty, and we are the guardians of this democracy and this republic, whichever way you want to talk about it.
Yeah, that is well put. Sarah Longwell, David Frum, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Charlie.
And thank you for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. Our special convention coverage continues. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back tomorrow. We will do this all over again, and there are now 67 days to go until the general election.